Good. Okay, well, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to speak here, and thanks for everybody to stick around. My talk will be a little bit, completely not related to cryptography. Because if you try and do this over a finite field, it's not hard. So I'll do it over rationals. And the challenge here is actually more to figure out whether it is a computational challenge than not. Because the motivation for what I'll be discussing is basically Hilbert's 10th problem, to design an automatic procedure that, given a polynomial with integer coefficients and a couple of variables, decides whether it has an integer solution or not. That's always good to start with a general problem that's been solved. It can't be done. And in fact, the proof for that is amazingly explicit. If you look at it, they actually generate a one-parameter family of polynomials in a bunch of variables, and they prove that even for that one-parameter family, you can't give such an algorithm. But you can change the question a little bit. If you restrict to the subclass of polynomials that they use in the proof, of course, the answer is still negative. But you could wonder, are there other subclasses of polynomials? For instance, if you restrict the number of variables, I think they need not even that many variables, but still quite a few, something like 12 or something like that. Yeah. And we could look at, say, rational solutions rather than integer solutions. And even the general question is actually still open for rational solutions. And what we'll do today is actually look at smooth projective curves over Q. If you look at this question in the most general form, you're actually not just looking at one equation anymore. You can have all kinds of models. You might have to do some work to get the smooth in there, and the projective. And that question is still open too. In fear of trying to do something too general, we'll restrict it even a little bit further. We'll look at Dilbert's 10th problem. Decide for small genus 2 curves whether there are rational points on them or not. Where small genus 2 curve is simply a curve that has a model y squared equals a sextic in x, where the coefficients of the sextic are integers between minus 3 and 3. So that's only a finite number of curves, but that doesn't make the problem a finite problem, because even for one single curve, it's not clear that you can answer the question. Okay, well, there's a bunch of strategies you can take for this. The thing is, if a curve does have a rational point, there's a good algorithm of showing that. Just start enumerating points, candidates of points, until you bump into one that actually lies on the curve. And so if your rational points in general are countable, the point that lies on the curve must be of some finite height bound, but a finite height, so you'll bump into it after a while. So the problem is to basically show that if you try that on a curve that doesn't have points, that you will not terminate. So if you're starting to solve this question for a given curve, the first thing you should try and do is convince yourself that it might be the case that there's no rational points on it, so you should just look for a couple of points on it. Search for points up to a height bound of 10,000 or something like that. I wouldn't suggest to take logarithmic height up to that number, but try x coordinates with numerator and denominator bounded by 10,000 and see if you get a square. Okay, if you fail at finding a rational point due to that, you might start wondering that there might not be a rational point on there, and there's some easy ways of showing that sometimes. For instance, if you can show the curve doesn't have any points over a bigger field, for instance, if you're looking at a sex stick that has a negative leading coefficient and doesn't have any real roots. You're always looking at a negative number on the right side, and squares of the reals are positive, so you won't get any solutions. You could do the same thing for p-adic fields. And that's actually questions that you can solve in finite time, both for a given p and for r. And in fact, with a little bit of work, you can show that if you take a curve over q, then there's, for all but finitely many explicitly determinable primes, you will have local solvability. So you only have to check it for a finite number of primes. You can actually just do that. The problem is that having points everywhere locally, not having a local obstruction, is not necessarily a sufficient condition for having a rational point on your curve, if you're looking at higher genus curves. It's a good start, but it will not necessarily resolve your problem. So the next step is to perturb your problem a little bit. There's a nice theorem of Chevalier and Weil. If you take an unramified Galois cover of your curve, say D over C, then there's a finite collection of twists. So that's modifications of the Galois structure, the Q Galois structure of this cover D, such that the rational points of these covers taken together map down to C, actually cover all the rational points on C. The big point is that you only need a finite collection of twists there, and you can at least in principle explicitly compute what these deltas are. And for hyperelliptic curves, as I'll show later, that this is actually something that you can do quite effectively too. So the idea now is to come up with a suitable collection of covers like this, and perhaps you can succeed in proving that each of these covering curves has a local obstruction, much like this one here. And therefore, you might be able to prove that none of the D deltas have rational points, and therefore, if you map these empty sets all down to C, you'll be looking at an empty set, and therefore show that C doesn't have any rational points either. The interesting thing is that actually can give new information with respect to the first point. Okay, well, if that also fails, sort of as an intermediate step, you might want to determine the Moerdijk-Weil group of the Jacobian of this curve and check if, oh, well, that shouldn't be the Jacobian of C, that should just be the curve. If you have a rational degree, if you don't have a rational degree one divisor clause on your curve, well, then your curve doesn't have a rational point either, because a point would be an example of a rational degree one divisor clause. The converse doesn't hold. And since pick one would have points everywhere locally when you're in this situation, it would actually represent some homogeneous space if you're Jacobian that's everywhere locally solvable. And therefore, if it doesn't actually have a rational point, it will represent something in the Tetchev-Rogers group of the Jacobian. And if you can actually determine this thing, then you should also be able to recognize non-trivial elements in the Tetchev-Rogers group. So at least if the Tetchev-Rogers group is finite, that's something we don't know, but something you might conjecture, then that this is something you should be able to decide. That might not be easy. And once you have that information, you can try Moerdijk-Weil sieving, and that's actually something that's generally applicable once you have all the information that's required to do that process, and I'll discuss what that actually is. And this is something that actually we have a good heuristic for why that should basically why you might believe that will succeed in proving that a curve doesn't have any rational points if it doesn't. Okay, so Coming back to Dilbert's 10th problem, some statistics. Here we have, we're looking at these curves, right? Y squared equals the sextic in X with coefficients between minus 3 and 3 integers. Okay, so you can enumerate that. That gives you 7 to the 7th possibilities. That's quite a bit bigger than the 200,000 that's quoted there. But there's a whole bunch of equations there that actually don't describe genius 2 curves. You just throw those away. And there's all kinds of things you can do to this equation, too. You can replace x by minus x, for instance. That gives you a different equation, but actually still gives you the same curve. And you can flip the whole polynomial around. So if you mod out by these isomorphisms, you end up with roughly 200,000 distinct curves represented by models of this form. Okay, of those, if you just start searching for rational points on them, there's this roughly 140,000 that seem to have a rational point. That's a remarkably high number until you realize how small your coefficients are, and as soon as F6 or F0 is 0 or 1, there's already a very obvious rational point on these things. So, in fact, the high number of curves that actually do have a rational point, this 70% here, is definitely an artifact from the small numbers we're using here. So that's this is not typical. If you would increase these bounds minus 3 to 3 here, you would definitely expect that this percentage goes down by quite a bit. And in fact, as you let your bound grow, you would expect that that percentage here would tend to 0. I think you'd expect 0% of curves of higher genus to have any rational points. Okay, so that leaves these roughly 60,000 curves that might, for which you might believe they don't have rational points. If you count the curves that are everywhere locally solvable, so we're just looking at a local local obstructions doesn't show you that the curve does not have any rational points, you're left with this 85%. So that's including the ones that actually do have rational points. So that leaves these 30,000 curves over here that probably don't have rational points, but for which we haven't been able to show it by local arguments. You might wonder about this percentage, 85% here. In fact, if you do the statistics, if you look at local solvability of a genus 2 curve at a very large prime, you'll see that it actually has to have very bad reduction to have no points locally. Because if it doesn't have too bad reduction, then the model in reduction will probably still have a non-singular component, and if your field is big enough, it will have some points that lie outside the intersection with the singular components, and therefore you'll probably have a point that lifts. So if you from that you can make rigorous that it's basically mainly the small primes that contribute to the to local obstructions, and if you do the asymptotics, you can actually show that about 85% of all genus 2 curves, counted in an appropriate way, enumerated by height, 85% of all genus 2 curves should be everywhere locally solvable. And that's actually a percentage that we find here as well. So that percentage apparently doesn't get skewed by small numbers, and there's no particular reason why it should. So the data here is, in a way, a little bit misleading in that we get this only 30% of the curves or only 15% of the curves on which we still have to work, right? So we think local solvability did a lot for us. But the thing is, due to small numbers, the 85% that we should have ended up with, already 70% of those had, just by fluke of small numbers, actually did have a rational point. So this is the part where we're where we stack the deck in our favor, a little bit by going for small numbers. Okay, so so the next thing now will be to just look at a covering collection, try and apply Chevrolet-V and use local obstructions on the covers. The nice thing is you can actually formulate it for two covers in a way that allows you to completely avoid explicitly talking about the covers. And the idea is the following. It's basically the idea of two descent, but now applied to the curve rather than the Jacobian. Well, your curve is basically given by this polynomial f of x, so you form this algebra where you mod out by this polynomial f of x. So, typically, f will be irreducible and you're looking at some degree 6 number field. You define a nice map. You map a point, your points x, y on the curve to x minus theta, so you just forget about the y coordinate. And you regard that value as a unit in this algebra, so not a zero divisor, modded out by squares and modded out by scalars. Turns out that's what you have to mod out by. We'll not go into the details of that. So this map a priori isn't defined everywhere, because where does the point at infinity go? And if you'd have any branch points here, points where roots x of f, then this wouldn't work either, because then this wouldn't be a unit. But you can fix that. You can extend this map to cover the entire thing. Okay, so we have this map mu here that sends rational points to this, well, to be determined group over there. And you can do the same thing locally. And if you have a rational point, then the diagram should nicely commute. And the nice thing is you can actually compute the images over here. So we define the fake two-Selmer set of the curve to consist of all those deltas here that when you map them to any of the local versions, this actually does get hit by a local point. Okay, so with a bit of work, you can show that this is actually a finite set. It's supported at the group here that's only generated by finitely many primes. So the geometric interpretation of this is the following. So the definition of the fake two-Selmer set is repeated here. Again, we're doing the descent on the curve now, not on the Jacobian, so this is really just a set. It's not a group anymore, as it is when you do this for the Jacobian itself. Okay, so the interpretation is that you can actually associate to a delta like this a cover d delta to C for which the automorphism group is the two torsion of the Jacobian. Well, this automorphism group does come with a Galois structure, and you can show that it has the same Galois structure. So this is really just this Galois modules. And the fake bit in there comes from the fact that you have your hyperelliptic involution, and that you have if you have such a cover, you can always compose it with a hyperelliptic involution, which flips the sign of your y-coordinate. Well, the way we defined mu, it didn't refer at all to the y-coordinate, so it's not going to pick this up. So you can, if you have a cover pi delta like this, you can make it into another cover, iota composed with pi delta. And as a cover, that's not necessarily isomorphic in the sense that it's not clear that you can find an isomorphism from d delta to d delta, an automorphism of d delta in that way, such over the base field, over Q, such that this diagram commutes. And whether this fake two-Selmer set is actually equal to the full, the real two-Selmer set, which would really qualify, parametrize covers like this, is a question of whether you can actually find such an isomorphism there. But in fact, we shouldn't care for our applications, because even if these things are not isomorphic as covers, the curves here, this d delta and d delta over there, are still isomorphic, still the same curve. So if one of those has a local obstruction, the other one does too. And okay, so the Chevalier-Wey criterion now becomes that the rational points on your curve are covered by the images of the rational points on d delta and these compositions with the hyperelliptic involution. But if you've just shown that this fake two Somerset is empty, then, well, certainly you're taking a union, empty union here, so you will not have any rational points. So for our applications, we really don't have to refer to the covers at all. You can just do this computation. And computationally, the hardest ingredient here is that you'll need some S units group out of, well, probably a sextic number field. If your algebra splits up in smaller degree fields, you just have to do it for the factors individually, which is probably a lot easier. Okay, so if we do this, we end up with the following data. Okay, so we're here. We have these ever locally solvable curves that probably don't have irrational points. Those are the ones on which we'll want to do our argument. So we compute the fake two Somersets for each of those 30,000 curves. And we find that most of those two fake two Somersets are actually empty. So you get rid of a lot of curves. You're only left with these 1492 curves, or about 1%. Again, well, yeah, I haven't worked out the asymptotic, but since you're just using a fixed covering collection here, and you're just looking at local solvability within this covering collection, I would expect that asymptotically there should still be a positive percentage of curves that sort of don't succumb to this approach to showing there's no rational points on them. Let's see. So the fact that we end up with this only 1% here, on which we have to do a little bit more, is again helped a bit, I bet, by the fact that a lot of the curves that we can't show don't have any rational points really just happen to have a rational point in our case. Okay, so now we come to Mordevai-Sieving. The idea is the following. We'll need the Mordevai group of the Jacobian, the set of rational points on the Jacobian anyway. And as I discussed, pick one is a homogeneous space of your Jacobian, or is represented by a homogeneous space like that. And if your curve does have points everywhere locally, this homogeneous space is going to have points everywhere locally, and therefore it represents something in the Tetyevrevich groups. And if we can show it represents something non-trivial, then we know the curve doesn't have any rational points. And if it does represent zero, then we should be able to find a rational point in there. That's to say, we should find a rational degree one divisor class on our curve. And because our curve actually does have points everywhere locally, we should even be able to represent that divisor by a rational divisor. That just makes computations a little bit easier. So at this point, the discussion I'm following through here doesn't even need hyperelliptic curves anymore. You could apply this to any curve. Whether you can actually do the computations involved to get the information that you need might be something different. But so if you pick a nice enough prime, you can just look at the equation of your curve C and work out what the reduction map is. So you get this reduction from the rational points on your curve to the Jacobian of the curve over a finite field, the reduction of it, and you have a kernel of reduction there, which will be some finite index subgroup of your Mordevai group. I forgot to mention that. From now on, we'll just fix this embedding and regard our curve as a subvariety of our Jacobian. So we'll just work with that. Okay, so we have this embedding, C inside, well, the rational points of C will land inside the Mordavai group of the Jacobian. You have a reduction map on this side. You have a reduction, concept of reduction on your curve itself. And then you have a local version, or a reduced version of your embedding map as well. If you have good reduction, that still works fine. And again, for a rational point, this diagram should commute. So the idea now is, if you compute the intersection of the image of reduction map here together with the image of the curve over the finite field, you'll find some information modulo this finite index subgroup about where rational points of your curve lie inside your Mordavai group. So this does give you some information. In fact, it is possible that these images miss each other completely, which is not entirely a local affair because you've put in some global information here. So that can actually happen. You can have that VP here is empty even if your curve does have points everywhere locally. And then you've just shown that your curve doesn't have any rational points. But there's something nicer, and that is that if you do this, add a bunch of primes such that the kernels of reduction don't sum to the entire group. So that's if you regard your finite index subgroups here as a modulus, this basically corresponds to the moduli being non-co-prime. Well, then you don't have a Chinese remainder theorem, right? So it can actually happen that if you intersect the cosets modulo lambda p and the cosets modulo lambda q, this intersection can actually be empty even if these cosets collections individually were not empty. It's just Chinese remainder theorem in a higher dimensional situation. Now you're working in a finitely generated abelian group of rank larger than one, possibly. Okay, so this is a way of combining local information at distinct times. And you can scale up that argument a bit. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Yeah. It's a collection of. No. Oh, sorry. Oh, I guess I should. Yeah. You're right. I should take rho p inverse of this. Sorry. Yeah. I know you're right. That's what the plus lambda p here indicates, because this is a coset modulo lambda p, and by adding lambda p, I'm sort of interpreting it as a subset of that. Yeah. Okay, so we scale this up a bit, and we do this for finitely many primes, say a collection of primes S. So you probably want to take these primes good, although you could include bad primes as well. You just have to do a little bit more work to figure out what the conditions are then. This is an idea that's been used by Shurashkin first, and Victor Flynn and I have used it on other examples as well. And now, Bjorn Poonen actually worked out a heuristic that's quite convincing, but it's only a heuristic, but the intersection of these images of rho s and is over here, so if you just combine all that information, you likely get a very small intersection. I'll make more precise how you take the limit here. So basically the argument says that if you take the size of the image here and the size of the image here, multiply that together and divide it by the size of the group in which it lives, that should tend to zero as you let S grow. Well, you have to be careful about how you choose S, of course. But, okay, and the sensible choice here seems to be, you want to make your choices such that you that things work out nicely. You want to pick your primes, well, bounded, in order to keep this term a little bit on the small side by making sure that there's not too many points in reduction on your curve. And in order to make sure that you get a lot of interaction between the different primes, you basically want to restrict the orders of the different factors that you get here between these groups. So you want to look at group orders that are smooth, B smooth. So we restrict to those primes smaller than B squared. The square is just there to have a bit of headroom, such that, well, our curve should have good reduction to make the argument easy, and we want the group order of the Jacobian to be B smooth. That's to say, if you factor this group order, it should only consist of prime factors at most B. Okay, the good thing about smooth numbers is they are plentiful. That is to say, if you look at the proportion of smooth numbers amongst all numbers up to a bound V, where you let your smooth bound vary as a power of your bound B, so U here would usually be a small positive number, then you're still ending up with a positive proportion. So as long as you make sure that your smoothness bound behaves like a power in your bound, you should still end up with a positive proportion. Okay, so in order to estimate the different terms that we have in our limit, the Weyl bound gives us approximate group orders of both the Jacobian and number of points on the curve. You should have about P to the G points on your Jacobian and about P points on your curve. And if we assume that the group order behaves as a typical integer of its size, then in fact we expect that the number of elements in S, which were primes up to B squared, so you have plenty of primes to choose from, such that this group order here is smooth. Well, this group order behaves like P to the G, so that's is well, at most B to the G, basically. So that behaves like a power in B. So if that has to be a smooth number, you should still end up with a positive proportion. So that's what this limit gives here. We should end up with a number of primes that that's proportional to B. So we have lots of things to choose from. Okay, so using the Weyl bounds here and filling it all in the formula gives you something like this. You just take the quotient of the number of points on your curve and the number of points of your Jacobian and take the product over all your primes. You get this P 1 minus G, and if you work it out, you get something that's about this size. So it's something, well, with a constant. This is a negative number, negative constant, and it's exponential in B squared. And it quickly decreases. Okay, so what remains is to look at how big the image of the Mordevais group is in this group. And the observation is, because we chose our group orders all to be smooth, there's only a limited number of prime factors that can occur in the group orders of the factors individually. So, in fact, this product will be far from cyclic. And that's a good thing in our situation. So if you compute the exponent of this group, you can just bound the different things that you have here. Our primes were at most B squared. You have about P to the G points on your curve, so you can bound your group orders here of each factor individually. You just assume that each of the groups individually is cyclic. So the exponent of each of the factors is just the size of the group. If it's not cyclic, it only helps us. So you get this product here. You can just bound these exponents like this. Because we were adding basically in all the possible group orders that we have here, you get a B to the number of primes up to b. And if you work it out, you get something that's exponential as a constant times b. So we, in the other term, we had a b squared here, and here we, now we only have a b. Okay, well, the Mordevais group itself has some finite rank. So it's only a fixed amount away from being cyclic in that respect. So its image in this big product here is going to be at most the exponent of the group to the power r. Well, and then you might have to account for a little bit of torsion, but that all goes in the O1. So if we add that all together, the expected size of the intersection of IS and rho S is just the product of these things. So that means that, well, if we flip the sign here, you get the difference of something times b minus something times b squared. So b squared grows quicker than b, so that goes to zero. So unless there's a good reason, you'd really expect that if you take S big enough, the intersections that you get here should just be empty. And, well, one good reason for not being empty would be if there's a rational point here, because that would just force there to be something in the intersection. And the idea of Mordevais sieving is now really to just do this in practice and hope that by picking your S big enough, you can actually show that the intersection of the reduction of your Mordevais group together with the curves in reduction is actually finite. It's empty. And Poonen's heuristic definitely suggests that you should be able to do that. So in order to do this, the problem is, well, this group here is going to be huge if you take S of any decent size. Already when you saw the asymptotics, you saw there that there were some constants in there. So in practice, you'll have to take your S of a reasonable size. So you can't just write down all the elements of this group and work with that or something like that. You have to be a little bit quicker. So one thing to do would be to just keep this as an abstract abelian group, which means that if you do take this map here, you have to take discrete logarithms. That's not so bad in our case, because we've actually made sure that our group orders are smooth. So discrete logarithms aren't so hard. And then the image of IS over here is still something huge, too. You don't want to write that down in one go either. So you really just want to work with quotients of this group and work your way slowly up while doing the intersections. So you really have to do some programming here to battle the combinatorial explosions, at which case we should probably just ask Dan Bernstein to come up with a good algorithm or something. You can basically analyze from just the point counts here, just assuming that things behave randomly, how big the images successively would be if you take different quotients, and then you can just sort of optimize and try and find a route such that none of your intermediate answers is extremely big. I mean, that's a computer science problem. I will not go into that. Okay, so if we apply this to our left 1492 curves, we find the following. So first of all, we have to determine the Mordevais groups of these curves. Under certain conditions, we've been able to do that for all of them. So this table here gives us the ranks. I'll later qualify which of those ranks are absolutely proven and which ones are not. And so once we had the Mordevais group, we could just do this Mordevais sieving. And as was already suggested by the asymptotics too, how hard it is to get this argument working is really sensitive to the rank of your Jacobian. This R was standing in front of the fact that it had the B that we had to beat. And I think for one of our rank 4 curves, we we actually needed something like 16 hours of computation. So it wasn't huge, but we needed information up to primes in the thousands. Okay, so the problem, of course, is that when you're determining your Mordevais groups of your Jacobians, you run into Tate-Shevorevich groups. So for all these curves, actually, we... okay, so in this column, it's... So here, for this rank 1 case, we actually found from the 2 descent rank bound of 3. So it could have been a rank 3 curve, except that we weren't able to find enough points. And then by using a... by using some trickery, we showed that that the rank was actually just 1, not 3. So that gives you a factor of z mod 2 z squared in the Tate-Shevorevich group. We also ran into cases where we weren't able to do that by a simple application of our visualization argument. And there, after a while, we started suspecting 4 torsion in the Tate-Shevorevich group. And then we went all out and took these curves, which are not modular, computed their L series, just assumed that they would actually continue, and look at the Birch-Swinnerton-Dyer information and see what the conjectured ranks would be according to Birch-Swinnerton-Dyer in this generalized form for non-modular genus 2 curves as well. And we also got from that what the conjectural order of the Tate-Shevorevich group was in it. It all added up. So it did. That's in this column here, the z mod 4 z squared, we computed. Well, yeah, for 4 entries in this column here, we were actually able to prove that the rank is what this table suggests that it is by an argument where we just needed the generalized Riemann hypothesis to actually verify our class group information. And for the rest of the entries, we only have the Birch-Swinnerton-Dyer information. Okay, but the outcome of this in the end is that we were able, at least conjecturally, to show that, to decide the solvability of these Dilbert curves. And if you don't want any conjectures in there, then there's still 42 curves left on which we are, well, for which we don't have an unconditional proof that they don't have rational points. Okay, well, that's it, basically. It would absolutely do that. Yeah, sure. You could even do this if you suspect a point of large height. You could do this, but in fact, if you have the generator of the Mordevais group anyway, you could generate points exponentially fast anyway. So I'm not sure it's worth it to do the sieving in that for that purpose, because you get quickly up to incredible height bounds anyway.